And you're listening to WSLR 96.5, low power FM in Sarasota, Florida. Yes. And Larry is going to introduce our next guest who's on the line with us, and that is Jacob. And Jacob, we are very honored to have you on our show from Refugees International. Jacob, say hello to our listening audience.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me on.
That's great. Jacob Kurtzer, let me just mention a little bit about him. Jacob Kurtzer, who is with is a congressional advocate with Refugees International, has been with them since May of 2007, advocating on their behalf on Capitol Hill. Refugee International is grounded in human rights conventions that define the rights of displaced people and the international obligations to protect them. It defends their rights to life, their personal liberty, their nationality, sanctuary and work, education and health care. We're going to talk today about Colombia, people forced from their homes by conflict. They are among the world's most vulnerable. Before this job, Mr. Kurtzer served as a legislative assistant for Congressman Robert Wexler, our own Democrat here in Florida, assisting and advising him on foreign policy, trade, and human rights, as well as staffing the Congressional Indonesia Caucus. He has also worked on legislative issues relating to drug policy, transportation, natural resources, crime, and the Caribbean. Wow, you know a lot of stuff. Prior to that, he was a volunteer with the American Anti-Slavery Group, and Charles Jacobs, quite a remarkable guy. I'm familiar with them.
Yeah.
When were you there, by the way?
I was at AASG in the fall of 2000. I had taken time off from studying at the University of Maryland, and I spent the fall semester period doing an internship there with Charles and some of their staff and Jesse Sage. It was really a great organization, and I think it was part of the springboard that led me to where I am now at Refugees International.
Did you know someone there by the name of David Rossini?
Not offhand. I was only there for a short period of
You're
time.
Sure. He was there 2000-2001, I believe.
Yeah.
In any event, Jacob has a bachelor's degree in philosophy with a citation in religious studies from the University of Maryland in College Park. Well, welcome. Let's get on to the subject at hand. We're really happy to have you here. This weekend, Sunday and Monday, I understand there's an event going on about Colombia. Could you kind of fill us in with that?
This is the Day of Prayer in Action.
Yes.
Yeah, well, we've, along with some of our colleagues in Washington, have organized an Advocacy Day and Awareness Day in Washington to highlight some of the more pressing humanitarian and human rights issues. So we'll have a series of events with speakers. It's essentially a conference for interested parties, and then we'll also combine it with some direct advocacy towards the administration, towards the Congress, to try to get people in Washington a little bit more familiar with some of the realities on the ground in Colombia, and then also to push our agenda, which promotes, humanitarian response for those people who have been uprooted by the conflict, and also to promote, a more aggressive human rights agenda, at least from the perspective of the United States and its dealings with Colombia.
Good. So what I'd like to do this morning in the time that we have about 30 minutes here with you, is tell us what's going on there now, so what the situation is in terms of the indigent population, et cetera, how they got there, why is this going on in terms of what are the conflicts that sort of seeded this, and then what can the Obama administration, United States, and you and I do to do something about it?
Sure. Well, I mean, to answer your first question, Colombia has, unfortunately been the site of a long and ongoing series of internal conflicts between the central government, quote-unquote left-wing guerrillas, right-wing paramilitaries, it's an irregular war in the sense that it's not two national armies fighting each other. It's a bunch of different groups with different agendas and different competing interests fighting all across the country. We know the names of the big organizations, the FARC, the former ELN and AUC. A lot of these organizations, which have seemed to have gone out of business, have been regrouping under different, different capacities, different names. But basically, you have this this war that's taken over the whole country. Most recently, it has become fueled less by politics and more by narco dollars. The competing guerrilla paramilitary groups are essentially fighting each other and fighting the central government for control of coca-producing areas, coca distribution areas, as a means of enriching their own pockets. And what's ended up happening is that, as in many cases around the world, the people that have suffered the most are the people who are caught in the crossfire. And as is often the case, those are the poorest of the poor, the most vulnerable people in the country. And so you have a situation where indigenous populations in the countryside, Afro-Colombians have been really hit, and the Afro-Colombians have really been hit hardest by this conflict. You have massive displacement in Colombia. It's something that people aren't really aware of, because when we think of Colombia, we don't think of, we don't conjure up the same sort of images of refugee camps that we're sort of accustomed to. When we, you know, most of us, when we think of refugee camps, we tend to think of, you know, Central Africa and Darfur, which has been so prominent. These images of masses of people crowding into a central area. The displacement in Colombia doesn't look like that, and it's much more difficult to get the compelling images to make Colombia, the awareness of Colombia, something that resonates with the United States.
All right, can we back up just 1 second here?
Sure.
So let's say a typical scenario. Let's say I'm in Colombia. An indigenous, let's say an Indian there, and I have some land, and now you have the FARC and these other groups which are involved with, let's say, cocaine and narcotics trafficking, and then you have the government kind of fighting them, and maybe another group or two sort of infighting, and here you are just a farmer trying to feed your family. The next thing you know, what would happen? They would take your land away, or are they
sure.
torturing people and then leaving people displaced? What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's difficult to say there's one scenario. I mean, you know, one thing that's not known about Colombia is it's got the highest rate of landmine accidents in the world.
Landmines?
Landmine accidents.
How did landmines get into this?
Because what happens is first of all, it's an irregular weapon. So in irregular combat, the guerrillas basically try to use whatever they can to protect themselves from government forces. So they make these extremely crude, improvised landmines. I mean, out of soda bottles, we're talking. And they put them either around their own encampment to protect themselves, or what oftentimes they'll do is they'll put them around a village, or they'll direct villagers in a certain way in order to essentially create a human buffer zone between them and opposition forces. And what's particularly distressing about the use of these landmines is because they're irregular landmines, they're virtually impossible to remove. So you have a lot of, you know, confined communities that have been essentially landmined in so that they can't leave their villages. But I'll just give you an example of another scenario from when I was in Colombia last May. There's a town called Sanchez in the southern part of the country along the river, the Rio Patillo, which has long been essentially a cocaine superhighway from the mountains out to the Pacific Ocean. And what you had in Sanchez when we arrived was a very compelling story, to use it, you know, not the best word, but the people that we found in Sanchez had been displaced from another community, and when they had gotten to Sanchez, they were able to squat there because the people of Sanchez had earlier been displaced by conflict. So you basically had a ghost town which was served as a refugee center for people who were fleeing from another village. And what they told us was they live in a coca-producing area. The FARC had come in and tried to take over and had tried to use the land to produce coca. Government forces came in, they were caught in the crossfire. What people described to us was fire coming from the air, which essentially means helicopter fire. And in this case, it was particularly distressing because we know that the rebels don't have access to helicopters. The only fighting force in this conflict with helicopters is the Colombian government, and we know where they get their helicopters from, and that's from the United States. And so the idea that helicopters were firing upon villagers that were not party to the conflict was particularly distressing to us. But in this case, you know, it was a crossfire situation, and villagers just fled to the closest safe area they identified, and that's where we came upon them.
So how do you find this out? I mean, are you on the ground, or are there reporters there, or are you getting stories from
sure.
people that survived? How do you get this kind of information?
Well, just 10 seconds of background on the organization. Refugees International is an independently funded advocacy organization. So we get all our money from private donors, individuals, and foundations. We don't take any money from the U.S. government or the U.N. And when I say we're an advocacy organization, we don't do on-the-ground operations. The benefit of both of these things is that it allows us both flexibility and it allows us to be aggressive in our advocacy and in our message. But what we rely upon is local partners a lot of times for information, for access to these areas. And so we've established relationships with organizations that work on the ground doing the immediate relief and humanitarian assistance. in this case, you know, we work very closely with the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, the UN High Commission for Refugees, and they were making their own visit to this community, and they allowed us the opportunity to essentially tag along with them so that we could do our own research. But we very often rely upon the assistance of either the large international agencies that many of us are familiar with, the Save the Children, Doctors Without Borders, or the international, you know, non-governmental, the ICRC, the Committee of the Red Cross, or the UN. And oftentimes, even more importantly, is our relationships with the local national groups. In Colombia, there's a very extensive civil society network of human rights and humanitarian agencies that, you know, are more than happy to provide us with logistical or technical or, you know, educational support for when we do our missions.
I just wanted to go back. That's a great description of the work and how it's done. I wanted to go back to the Colombia situation, and as you were describing it, I couldn't help but think of Obama, the president, being in Mexico and the discussion about the drug wars that are happening, particularly around the border. And of course, then to think also of the drug traffic coming out of Afghanistan.
Sure.
And, you know, in one way, you're tempted to think of a place like Mexico or Colombia or even Afghanistan as either a failed state, you know, like Somalia, where, you know, just things go completely out of control. Or if not a failed state, a government that's just not capable of providing some kind of protection for its people when these drug lords come in with all their money and guns and helicopters and what else. And I guess if you were thinking about it, even apart from the United States intervention, what in these nations' scope of realm of reality could they possibly do to get some order back into the country or some control around this? What are some things that the local governments and are able to even do?
Sure. Well, I think two things. You know, I think it's very important to distinguish between a country like Colombia and a country like Afghanistan. You know, it's obvious, but in the context of this discussion, I think it's really important to recognize that Colombia is not a failed state. It's actually a very highly developed country. It's one of the reasons they get so sensitive about the level of displacement, because they're lumped in with countries like Sudan and Somalia when on any sort of objective measure, it's a much different place. I think Colombia raises a lot of interesting questions for an organization like mine, for a foreign policy person at the State Department. Do you deal more aggressively with countries that have the capacity or more aggressive, you know, and are trying to do the right things? Or are you more aggressive with the people who are, you know, difficult to deal with and not making any effort at all? I think we have to be, it's important to be honest in our assessment of Colombia. I mean, we're a humanitarian organization, so we're going to push the humanitarian agenda as strongly as possible.
And I guess what leverage do you have in either of those scenarios, too?
Well, I mean, leverage is an interesting question. I mean, we have the ability to put pressure on through public awareness on policymakers in the United States. And Colombia is actually interesting for the organization. It's one of the countries where we do the most advocacy inside the country. We have relationships now with legislators in the Colombian Parliament, with people in the Attorney General's office and other government agencies, where we can show them our reports and we can point to problems that are happening. But to go back to your question, we try to be pragmatic and practical in looking at these situations. The Colombian government has engaged in an aggressive counter-guerrilla campaign over the last 10 years, 15 years, that started with President Clinton, Plan Colombia. And part of that was military aid, and a much smaller part of it was humanitarian and economic aid. And the military aid has achieved, on some level, some of its objectives. I mean, if you look at cities like Bogota, Cali, and Medellin, they're livable cities now. They used to be controlled by gangs and by these same guerrilla groups. There has to be an acknowledgement that there have been gains made in the extension of state power over the entire territory of the country of Colombia. That being said, it's our feeling that for too long the United States' approach to Colombia has been a military approach, a military relationship with humanitarian and economic aid thrown in at the end to to appease those of us who find those things important. What we saw about 2 years ago was that Congress changed the aid package. When Democrats took over the Congress, they reoriented the distribution of our aid assistance program to Colombia from what was essentially about a 75-25 split tilting towards military assistance to a much closer 50-50 split, increasing the amount of economic support and increasing the amount of humanitarian assistance, which we felt was long overdue and was very necessary.
Let me just step in here, excuse me, Jacob, because
sure.
We need to remind our listeners that they're listening to WSLR, Low Power FM, Sarasota, your community radio station, and the Surreal News, news and information. And our guest is Jacob Kurtzer with Refugees International. We're talking about Colombia. And let me just ask you this, and don't want to interrupt your answer on the other one, but are you suggesting, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, that the government of Colombia, though it is making some progress, actually could do more, that it is has more resources, is more sophisticated, but perhaps because of, oh, I don't know, internal corruption or, you know, distractions from some other things, is not paying as much attention to the social and economic solution to this problem as much as it just wants to go in with a, you know, and act their way through the drug lords and use a law enforcement or military approach to get rid of them.
That would essentially be, my contention. I believe that for a very long time, the Colombian government took a very aggressive approach militarily to the problem of narcotics trafficking and cultivation. A quick backgrounder. I mean, Colombia has on the books one of the most progressive sets of laws for dealing with an internal displacement. They actually have a very good framework in place legally for how to respond when a community gets displaced by the conflict. The problem is in the implementation. Essentially, if there's a displacement, the local government is supposed to respond for the first 72 hours to provide the basic food and shelter, and then the municipal government and then the federal government. So there's this whole framework in place that's actually quite progressive. The problem is in resources and in political will to implement it. So in some of the municipalities we visited, it seemed as if they had the money, but the governor or the mayor just didn't care, and just, you know, felt like, I have all these dollars here, or, not dollars, but, you know, I have all this money here. I'm going to spend it on, you know, my constituents. Why am I going to spend our city's money on a group of people who come from somewhere else and are going somewhere else? There's no political benefit for Mayor X to spend this money on this community. And the second problem that we encountered was mayors or governors who were more than willing and who understood the law as it applied to them, who were more than willing to implement the programs that they were required to, but had no money and were unable to do the programs because they just didn't have the resources. And so what we're suggesting is let's help the Colombian government apply its own laws and apply its own framework for dealing with these humanitarian crises by providing them the economic support, and also in some cases it's just technical and logistical support at a very local level. It's trainings for mayors, it's trainings for new governors about what the law is. And so that's what we're suggesting is some of this massive aid package that we give to Colombia, you know, essentially an ally of ours in South America, be redirected and shifted towards more humanitarian and more economic support.
Do they even need it?
I think they do. I mean, at a certain point in time, you know, with any foreign assistance program, the design of a program should be that it phases itself out. But I think given the size of displacement in Colombia, I mean, we're talking internal Colombian figures are over 4 million people. External figures vary a little bit, but you have almost 300,000 new displacements a year. I mean, the magnitude of the crisis is still large enough that I think it would be difficult to expect the Colombian government to be capable of responding on its own. And I think, given the fact that the United States has identified safety and security inside Colombia as a national security priority, that we have a responsibility, if it's a priority, to to look at how we can provide safety for the people of Colombia.
All right, so sort of as an outsider looking in here with a somewhat naive point of view, you could say, well, there's corruption there, and here I am in the United States, you know, earning and paying taxes, and we all know about paying taxes because we did that this week. Why should we be giving money to a corrupt system where the aid is being used maybe in a naive way to sort of get the warlords more power rather than to actually accomplish? And you know, here in the United States, we never give money to people that are corrupt, right?
Right. Sure. I mean, I understand the concerns an American taxpayer would have right now about giving money into a corrupt system. I would say two things in response to that. One, in every assistance program we have, we're supposed to have checks and accountability to make sure that the money isn't going to the wrong hands. In this case, the kinds of programs that we've been advocating for, I feel, are actually less prone to corruption. A lot of it is training that would be done in Bogota by, you know, U.S. embassy officials or by reliable U.S. contractors, trainings about how to implement the program. I think there's a lot more opportunities for corruption when you're talking about massive military transfers. The potential for diversion is very high. The second point is there's historically and consistently a problem with foreign assistance, with advocating for foreign assistance, because American taxpayers say, well, this is our taxpayer dollar, why are we sending it overseas? And, you know, people from my community consistently point to the same statistic, which is, on average, Americans overestimate the amount of money we spend on foreign assistance and support a figure that's higher than we actually spend. So when asked, when people who don't know what the actual percentage of our overall budget is spent on foreign assistance, people assume it's more and generally would support a level higher than the one that we actually have. And I think we have to think about foreign assistance in the context of our overall national, if part of our overall national interest. I think most Americans would be more than happy to spend on our national defense. And I think one of the things you have to think about foreign assistance is that it's part of an overall national security, national defense program. Instability in our hemisphere, instability around the world, threatens U.S. national interests. And I think in addition to the morality of helping those people who are less fortunate, it is also vitally a U.S. national interest to provide assistance around the world, but specifically in our own hemisphere, specifically in a country like Colombia, which is a linchpin to safety and security in the upper half of South America.
So are you saying here that just providing military aid throughout the world and just bombing the heck out of people isn't going to help our national security?
Oh, come on. He couldn't be saying that.
We may actually help to have to use some humanitarian efforts and some negotiations to further our national security?
Steve, he couldn't be suggesting that. No, not at all.
Yes.
And how about other countries participating in Colombia? And then to sort of switch gears and talk about, well, Colombia isn't the only problem in the world, too. But anybody, how about our other allies kicking in and helping us in this effort? Because that would help them out as well.
In Colombia?
Yes.
Well, I mean, I think we're a U.S.-based agency, so we don't pay as much focus to what other donor countries are doing. But I do know that many of the EU, the European Union countries, have a very strong presence in funding humanitarian assistance in Colombia. One thing that's interesting, not just in Colombia, but really around the world, is the different paradigm for the provision of humanitarian assistance. In the United States, U.S. assistance often comes with a lot of strings attached, which is, you know, for better or for worse, how we do it. But many countries around the world have a slightly different perspective to humanitarian assistance, which is that they have decided that humanitarian assistance is a good in and of itself and essentially provide it not carte blanche for people to do with as they please, but without these sort of restrictions on where it can be spent, how it can be spent, but really basically going to where it's needed most. So, you know, when we were in Colombia last May, which is, you know, I like to speak from the personal experiences I have, we did have the opportunity to visit with other donors, and other countries are putting in funding. The U.S. isn't there alone, which I think is an important point to convey to those taxpayers who are concerned about how our dollars are being spent. We're not there alone. We're there with partners.
All right, we have just a couple minutes left, and our next segment coming up is about voting here in Florida, which, you know, is never a problem.
Sure.
And how about bring us around the world? Since you're with Refugees International, we're speaking with Jacob Kurtzner, who is our guest here on the Surreal News Show. Take us out of Colombia. Where else in the world should we be looking for similar types of problems?
Well, I mean, again, I would emphasize that Colombia is actually really interesting because it's so unique in its dynamics. But in terms of massive displacement, you know, I think we're all pretty well in tune with the situation in Sudan. It's obviously been exacerbated since the indictment of President Bashir and the closing of the operations of many of the agencies operating in the Darfur area. I would encourage people to look more closely at the situation in Somalia. I think, you know, the American public eye turns to Somalia once in a while, especially when there's something that seems, you know, so silly as piracy. But obviously the situation with pirates in Somalia is much more complex than just a bunch of guys boarding a boat. It's a dynamic that's rooted in, you know, long-running instability inside the country. You know, Somalia has, we call it the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, and we cover all of the worst of them. But the dynamics in Somalia are just absolutely horrendous, where you have massive displacement, an inability of aid agencies to operate, natural disasters all happening simultaneously. And it's out of this desperation that people turn to things like piracy as a means of providing for them and their families. Now, I'm not suggesting that pirates are Robin Hoods or anything like that, but I'm suggesting that the issue is greater than just merely the boarding of international boats. It's a massive humanitarian crisis, and this is a manifestation of it. So I would encourage people to look more closely at the situation in Somalia, and to you know, it's an extremely difficult situation. It's one of these areas where, you know, our humanitarian interest runs up against the, you know, quote unquote war on terror, and we're stuck with very difficult decisions about how to respond to a crisis.
Yeah, and these are things you're not going to hear played out in the mainstream media, because it's hard to get good sound bites to pull all this stuff together in a 15-second sound bite.
Yeah.
Could I just ask if you've sensed a difference in the just quickly? We only have
30 seconds.
If you've sensed a difference in the Clinton State Department, she doesn't seem to be a very public figure yet, although you've seen her. Are they turning around the State Department more in the direction you'd like to see it turned around in towards these issues?
I believe so. I mean, if you just look at the early statements from the Clinton State Department, from the Obama White House, I mean, you had the secretary in Burma talking about renewing our approach and looking at humanitarian assistance inside a country that we haven't, you know, had engagement with in quite some time. You have a response to the situation in Somalia, which talked about the political process. You have an approach to Colombia. I mean, President Obama published an op-ed before the Summit of the Americas talking about a new day and an approach to the region that's not piecemeal, but that actually looks at how we can support each other and, you know, move towards greater engagement.
Great.
And I think it's obvious that the campaign that the president ran on engagement, diplomacy, and mutual respect is actually being implemented in the White House and in the State Department.
Terrific. Jacob Kurtzner, thank you very much. Refugees International,
yeah,
filling
us
in Columbia.
Thank you for having us.
Take good care. Bye-bye.
Very good.